A terrifying truth lies beneath the surface. A man lay suffocating in the dark, having been declared dead in 3 seconds by a doctor who simply decided his time was up.
And that decision, I mean, the speed of it,
Yeah.
the absolute authority that went unquestioned, that's really the heart of our deep dive today.
Yeah, we are following this single just astonishing narrative. It's from 1965, Bakersfield, California.
Right. And it involves a collapse, a declaration of death that was practically instantaneous, and, well, a literal resurrection from the very brink of burial.
Our mission here is to follow that precise, horrifying chain of events. We've gone through the sources, and we need to understand not just what happened to this man, Frank Delaney.
But why? Why the incredible speed? Why the terrifying confidence of the man responsible nearly created this absolute nightmare?
And this isn't just a simple case of misdiagnosis. I mean, that happens, sadly. This is something else. It's a chilling look at how complete hubris, you know, fueled by fraud, can just short-circuit the entire system that's supposed to protect us.
And for you listening to this, it's a really crucial look at the dangers of unchecked expertise and just how fragile public trust can be when we're confronted with that kind of medical authority.
Especially back then.
Exactly. Someone puts on that white coat, especially in an era where, you know, information wasn't everywhere like it is today. You're just conditioned to accept what they say is final.
And this is the story of the moment that system just completely broke down. It revealed this fault line between a legal declaration on a piece of paper and actual biological reality.
A terrifying gap.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We have to start by setting the scene. We're talking mid-1960s, a time and a place where the authority of the local doctor was, well, almost absolute.
Right. And we need to introduce the central figure here, the man at the center of this catastrophe. He called himself Dr. Stanley R. Moore.
So Bakersfield, California, 1965, what kind of place are we talking about?
Well, it's not a huge, complex city. Moore's office was a small medical practice right there on Main Street. And the environment itself is just critically important to understanding this.
How so?
The materials we've reviewed all highlight the structure of his practice. It was a solo operation, completely solo.
So no checks and balances?
None. No hospital committees looking over his shoulder, no peer reviews, no partners in the office who could just offer a second set of eyes or, you know, challenge a hasty decision.
That detail alone, that structural detail, it just immediately raises a dozen red flags, especially in medicine.
Of course.
In a solo practice, particularly half a century ago, the doctor is the institution. There's no one to question their judgment. So the gap between what's, you know, legally allowed and what's medically necessary, it can get huge.
And Moore exploited that gap perfectly. He really did. And in that kind of vacuum, with no accountability, what do you rely on?
Appearance. Performance.
Exactly. Performance. Moore's success wasn't built on competence. It was built on presentation. He wore the uniform, the white coat, and the sources. All, every single one of them emphasized his very confident tone.
So the confidence was a substitute for the knowledge.
It was the substitute for actual knowledge and for due process. If you deliver a judgment, especially one as traumatic as telling a family their loved one is gone with absolute certainty, well, people who are in shock, who are grieving, they are far less likely to question you.
So the confidence was the show. And what was the motive? The sources are really clear on this. He was known for one thing.
Speed.
Speed. His appointments were notoriously short. I want to pause on this for a second because it really seems to be the key to his whole professional philosophy, a philosophy that made what happened later almost inevitable. Why was speed his defining trait?
It's often the first warning sign about focus on throughput, especially in high-stakes professions. When a medical practitioner starts prioritizing the maximum number of people in the minimum amount of time, it changes the entire practice.
It's not about healing anymore.
No. It becomes an assembly line. And for Moore, this focus on speed, it served two purposes. First, obviously, it maximized his income. But second, and this is far more relevant to our story, it masked his profound professional deficiencies. He couldn't afford a long, detailed diagnosis because he just didn't have the foundational knowledge to perform one.
He was running a clock on his own fraud.
That's a great way to put it. The faster the patient moved through his system, the less likely they were to ask complex questions. The less time Moore had to spend pretending to have expertise he didn't actually possess.
His whole goal was just procedural completion. Process the patient, keep up the illusion of competence, and move on to the next one.
And that's the tragic stage that's set for the patient in our story, Frank Delaney.
He was 58 years old. And he comes into this high-speed, efficiency-first environment for what the sources just call a routine visit.
Just a routine visit. Not an emergency, not some complex procedure he was scheduled for.
No. Frank Delaney was just looking for some basic medical reassurance. And during that visit, that very routine visit, he collapsed.
And that moment, the collapse, that's the moment of truth for any medical professional. You have to act fast, yes, but you also have to act competently. You have to figure out the cause. Is it a simple faint? Is it a serious cardiac event? A stroke?
Or something immediately fatal?
Right. And Moore was presented with this situation that demanded a rapid, competent response. And instead, he just defaulted to what he knew, his learned principle.
Speed and decisive performance.
Which brings us directly to the instantaneous declaration of death. This is the absolute heart of this horrifying account.
From the moment Frank Delaney collapsed, the clock on his life, at least according to Dr. Moore, basically stopped after a count of three.
The pivotal 3 seconds.
We have to reconstruct this moment because the sheer absence of procedure is just staggering. Okay, so Delaney collapses. Moore, trying to maintain his whole facade of authority, he leans down, he checks for a pulse. But the shocking brevity of it is the real indictment.
He counted to three. The records state it clearly. One, two, three.
3 seconds. Let's be really explicit about what that means in a medical context, even back in 1965.
Standard procedure. I mean, even the most rudimentary medical assessment from that era requires significantly more time to verify that life has ceased. We're talking minutes, not seconds. A real check for vital signs requires assessing multiple systems.
So what should he have done? What would that process have looked like? I think for people listening today, we need to understand the scale of the negligence here.
Absolutely. The standard of care, even in the mid-60s, would have mandated checking for a pulse in at least 2 locations. Usually, you know, the carotid artery in the neck, which is close to the heart, and the radial artery in the wrist.
Okay.
And those checks are meant to last a minimum of 30 to 60 seconds each. Sometimes longer if the pulse is very faint.
Mm.
You also check for respiration. Is the chest moving? And crucially, you check pupillary response. Do the pupils react to light?
So Moore's 3-second count was...
It wasn't a medical examination. A forensic expert later called it an arbitrary pronouncement. It was a theatrical gesture. It was designed to convey decisiveness and authority. Nothing more.
It was basically the professional equivalent of saying, I looked... It's done.
Exactly.
And based on that 3-second gesture, he made the final fatal announcement. Frank Delaney was dead. But here's the critical pivot point in this whole causal chain. Moore then immediately bypassed every single piece of due diligence that should have followed that collapse.
The complete absence of standard procedure, it just confirms that his initial diagnosis wasn't just rushed. It was fundamentally negligent. It was willful.
If a patient collapses in a clinic, the protocol isn't just to check on them yourself, right? You have to escalate.
You have to escalate externally. And no escalation occurred. The sources confirm no ambulance was called.
And that decision is so crucial. Calling an ambulance isn't just about getting resuscitation equipment there.
No, it's about bringing in external, licensed emergency personnel. That whole system is designed to be a failsafe. You get trained witnesses, people who can apply more advanced diagnostics, oxygen, maybe even defibrillators. By skipping the ambulance, Moore effectively kept complete unilateral control over the narrative.
And horrifyingly, over the patient's body.
Yes. He avoided the one moment where his authority might have actually been questioned by a professional peer.
And since he was a solo practitioner, there was no second opinion requested. That further sealed Frank Delaney's fate if he'd just called another doctor from down the street.
That 3-second diagnosis would have been instantly exposed as reckless. Invalid.
But his priority wasn't confirmation.
No, his priority was formalization. He needed to get the paperwork signed. He had to do it before the biological reality of the situation could catch up with him. And that brings us to the astonishing speed with which he moved this lie from just a pronouncement into a legal fact.
The declaration of death led immediately to him signing the paperwork.
He moved at hyperspeed to notarize the lie, to turn a 3-second guess into official state documentation.
I have to ask, was the bureaucracy back then really so willing to just accept a death certificate based on a 3-second check?
In that era, yes. Mm. The system relied very heavily on the word of a licensed physician. If you showed up with a white coat and a signature, the presumption was that due diligence had been performed.
That death certificate is such a powerful legal instrument.
Immensely powerful. It doesn't just record a fact, it creates a legal reality. It formally stops an individual's life in the eyes of the state. It triggers insurance. And Most pressingly here, it releases the body for disposal.
So his urgency to get that signature on the paper.
It demonstrates his intent. He had to eliminate the risk of the patient reviving in his office and exposing his fraud.
And the family, tragically, they were in no position to question any of this.
They trusted him. They trusted the authority he presented implicitly. It allowed the entire process to just continue unchallenged.
That trust, especially in a small community in the 1960s, it was sacred. The doctor's word was law.
They were in shock. They were grieving. And they were just incapable of demanding a rigorous professional examination when faced with the absolute certainty that Moore was projecting. That unquestioning deference was the foundation. That's what allowed him to execute the next and almost final step.
The rapid disposal.
Right. The speed of the disposal just underscores the horrifying finality that this instant declaration imposed. The sources note the burial was scheduled for the very next morning.
The next morning. This wasn't a matter of giving the family weeks to grieve and plan. This was a logistical sprint to get Frank Delaney in the ground before anything or anyone could intervene.
The time frame is just grotesque. Less than 24 hours from a collapse during a routine visit to being lowered into the earth. It speaks to a system facilitated entirely by Moore's quick fraudulent certification that was running purely on efficiency. Administrative finality.
And he exploited the family's emotional vulnerability, knowing that a rush to finality often masks recklessness. And that speed brings us almost immediately to the most terrifying physical moment of this lie, the burial site. The next morning. This is where the paper reality of the death certificate crashes into the struggling biological reality of Frank Delaney.
Right, we're shifting now from that sterile, confident office environment to the heavy, somber atmosphere of the cemetery. The funeral service, according to all the accounts, went as expected.
The ritual of it. Prayers, silence, final goodbyes.
The protocol was being executed exactly as that signed death certificate demanded.
And then comes that ultimate, irreversible moment. The slow, deliberate lowering of the coffin. You can almost hear the machinery, the ropes going slack. That quiet, profound moment as the casket finds its place at the bottom of the grave. The lie is about to be sealed.
And that silence, it's so crucial for what happens next. In that quiet environment, every little noise is magnified. It's the transition between the living world above and the final resting place below.
The moment the casket settled, they were about to start filling the grave.
And then, the first sound. It wasn't loud. It wasn't immediately threatening. The sources suggest it was first mistaken for, you know, shifting dirt.
A rational explanation.
A rational explanation. People probably assumed it was the equipment settling or the ground giving way a little bit under the weight of the freshly dug earth. The mind always tries to normalize an anomaly first.
But it wasn't an anomaly that went away.
No. It persisted. It happened again. And this time it wasn't a shift. It was a sound. An intentional, distinct impact. Unmistakable.
He's knocking.
Knocking.
The sound of life fighting the finality of that paper lie, muffled by wood and earth. And what is, for me, maybe the most chilling detail here is Dr. Moore's immediate frantic attempt to just dismiss it.
We had everything invested in that narrative of death, didn't he?
His entire professional facade, his freedom, it was all riding on that hole being filled.
He couldn't allow a disturbance to negate his 3-second performance. So he reached for the most plausible yet most insulting explanation he could find. The sources say he laughed.
He laughed.
And claimed it was just the wood settling, a simple noise from thermal expansion.
He used confidence again. It's the same tool. That dismissive, authoritative laugh was his attempt to restore order, to normalize the sound, and to just push the burial over the finish line before anyone could truly panic.
But the sound came back. And the accounts say it was louder this time, more frantic. And now it was clearly directed upward.
So the anxiety in the crowd, which was probably already there because of how rushed this whole thing was.
It escalated. It became full-blown, undeniable terror.
The physical reality of the knocking finally superseded the authority and the signature of the doctor. People screamed. They were pleading with the crew to stop the burial immediately.
And that moment of collective chaos, that's the real turning point. Mm-hmm. It's where primal fear and just basic common sense override professional command.
The burial crew, thankfully, they reacted. They reacted to the terror and the undeniable sound.
They took immediate action. The equipment was reversed. The coffin was pulled back up. The ultimate rescue effort, initiated not by the so-called expert in the white coat, but by the collective panic and instinct of the witnesses.
And what they found inside? It's the stuff of genuine nightmare, Frank Delaney's condition.
He was alive, sweating profusely, panicking. The source materials are very clear. They emphasize he was very aware of what almost happened.
You have to pause and just try to grasp the sensory horror of what he went through.
Yes. He collapsed, maybe from syncope or a temporary cardiac issue, but he was not medically dead. He woke up, not in a bed or a hospital room, but in the blackest, most confined space you can imagine.
He could hear the muffled sounds of his own funeral above him.
And realized with his paralyzing horror that the movement he was feeling was downward, toward finality. The feeling of the air running out, the sweat, the absolute terror of knowing what was happening, but being unable to speak. It forced him into that primal act of knocking.
A last desperate attempt to communicate his own existence. He was suffocating, trapped in the physical embodiment of Moore's 3-second negligence.
He went from a routine patient to a prisoner in less than 24 hours.
Wow.
All because of a single reckless lie formalized by a signature.
Frank Delaney survived, thank God.
But Dr. Moore did not escape accountability. Not this time. And this is where the story shifts from this terrifying anecdote into a profound case study. A study in fraud, public trust, and the law.
The unmasking of the man who nearly buried a living person. It began almost the second that coffin was opened. The investigation zeroed in on Moore's behavior. And that scrutiny, it quickly exposed the core deception.
It turned out Stanley R. Moore was a complete fabrication. We're not talking about a legitimate doctor who made a terrible mistake.
No, we are talking about a man who had no medical license at all.
He held no legitimate degree from any accredited institution.
His entire professional existence, the confidence, the white coat, it was all built on purchase credentials.
The sources point specifically to mail order programs. In the mid-60s, before you had centralized computer records and the rigorous accreditation standards we have today, these fraudulent certificates could provide a veneer of legitimacy. And it was incredibly hard for the average person to see through it.
Mail order credentials. That phrase just says so much about the vulnerabilities in the system back then. He wasn't just hiding inefficiency. He manufactured an entire professional identity.
And suddenly his whole insistence on speed and efficiency, it makes perfect calculated sense.
Of course. He was running a con. And the quicker he could complete the transaction, the less chance there was of having to demonstrate any actual verifiable medical skill.
He was playing a role. And the system, because of its inherent trust and credentials, allowed him to maintain that illusion right up until the moment his victim literally knocked from his own grave.
This kind of fraud is so destructive because it attacks the most fundamental part of the public good, the medical profession. It takes advantage of that for purely selfish gain.
And the legal consequences that followed, they reflected the catastrophic severity of that betrayal. Prosecutors didn't just charge him with simple fraud for the mail order scheme.
No, the charges spoke directly to the life he nearly ended.
The charges were specific and very serious. Gross negligence, fraud, and attempted manslaughter.
We need to dissect that last one, attempted manslaughter. That elevates this from, you know, a civil malpractice case into a criminal act.
It does. Negligence implies a lack of care that leads to harm. But attempted manslaughter implies that his actions, while maybe not premeditated murder, were so reckless, they demonstrated such a wanton and conscious disregard for human life that they were a criminal act, an act that would have resulted in death if the victim hadn't been rescued.
So they argued that the 3-second diagnosis, carried out by a person who knew he was unqualified, was a deliberate act of recklessness.
Yes, he formalized the lie. And in doing so, he set in motion the mechanism that would kill Frank Delaney. That's a powerful legal argument.
Huh. The prosecution successfully argued that his underlying fraud made his negligence criminal. He didn't just fail to perform a standard procedure. He actively, confidently, and rapidly generated a document that removed all protections from the patient.
And that intentionality, disguised as competence, that's what sealed the attempted manslaughter conviction.
The evidence was just overwhelming. You have the living victim, Frank Delaney, sitting right there in the courtroom, across from the fraudulent practitioner who condemned him. The verdict was swift.
Convicted on all counts.
And the sentence.
Life in prison. And that is a truly massive sentence. It reflects not just the severity of the fraud, but the gravity of deceiving the public under the guise of authority when that deception leads directly to the imminent death of an innocent person.
A life sentence wasn't just punishment for one instance of malpractice. It was a societal declaration, a statement that asserting false authority to rush life and death decisions will be treated as one of the gravest crimes possible.
Moore loses his freedom for the life he nearly took.
But the true cost of those 3 seconds, the ultimate price of that fraudulent confidence, it really comes down to Frank Delaney's testimony at the trial. This is the emotional, visceral core of the entire experience.
His voice at the trial wasn't focused on the paperwork or the credentials. It was about the sensory experience of what he went through, the profound terror.
His memory was simple, but so chillingly effective. The last thing he remembered before the knocking
was waking up in the dark. Just think about that condensed horror. He wasn't in a peaceful coma. He was abruptly returned to consciousness in pitch black, in a confined wooden box, experiencing the full physical and mental assault of that environment.
And that was followed almost instantly by the dawning, paralyzing horror of realizing that everyone he knew, his entire world, believed he was already gone.
This wasn't just a physical threat. It was the ultimate, absolute betrayal of systemic trust. The world had moved on, sealed by a single fraudulent signature. He had been erased.
The person who was supposed to be his guardian of health became the architect of his premature death, all based on a single moment of laziness and calculated confidence.
And this is where we need to synthesize this case, connected to the broader themes we see in our deep dives. This whole narrative illustrates a terrifying truth about bureaucracy and reality.
We've talked about this before in other contexts, how official records can sometimes become more real than reality itself, overriding the physical world. How does that apply here?
Well, what's so fascinating here is the power of the flawed record. Moore's signed death certificate, based on that 3-second guess, it essentially froze Frank Delaney's life in the eyes of the law. The legal system, operating on the assumption that a doctor's signature is truthful, was ready to execute the burial. The paperwork became the new false reality.
And it instantly overrode the biological reality of a breathing, pulsing human being.
The bureaucratic machinery, which is designed to order things, to finalize them, it became a deadly weapon in the hands of a fraud. It's a system designed to trust authority. And when that authority is poisoned by self-interest, the system fails catastrophically.
So Moore's goal was never patient care. It was procedural completion.
Purely. His confidence and his speed were just symptoms of his underlying fraud. The primary objective was efficiency, maintaining a professional appearance, not an accurate diagnosis or the patient's well-being. He didn't see Frank Delaney as a collapsed human being.
He saw him as a paperwork problem.
A paperwork problem that needed a rapid resolution.
And the fastest way to process that problem, to remove the collapsed patient from his efficient schedule and his fragile, fraudulent practice, was to declare him dead.
And that speed masked the lack of competence perfectly. A legitimate doctor might spend precious minutes making sure the patient is truly gone, using multiple verifiable protocols. A fraud spends 3 seconds, because 3 seconds is all the time it takes to maintain the illusion of certainty before the problem gets outsourced to the bureaucracy of the funeral home.
So if we look back at the entire causal chain we've laid out, it's just horrifyingly clean, isn't it?
It is.
The foundation of fraud led to artificial confidence. That confidence required speed. Speed led to gross negligence, that 3-second diagnosis. Negligence led to the immediate formalizing of a lie on paper, and that lie almost led to disaster in the grave.
It's a perfect tragic loop, a demonstration of how institutional trust can be exploited. This case is a profound reminder that authority must always be checked. And that often, the simplest explanation for reckless behavior, that someone is cutting corners for their own convenience or gain, is the truth, even in the most serious life and death situations.
The fact is, Dr. Stanley R. Moore didn't just guess that Frank Delaney was dead. He simply declared Delaney dead because it was convenient.